item on the agenda, which is our technical activities issues and updates, and I'm going to give the ball to Henry Reese. Please, Henry.
Thank you very much. So this is paper 1B, and it's our usual report to you to provide you with an update on the various technical activities that have gone on in the period so that you can confirm that your satisfaction that all projects are proceeding in a manner consistent with the requirements of the due process handbook. We have followed the revised structure for this report that we introduced at the last meeting. So in the first section of the report, we have highlighted the due process decisions made in the period. In section two, we've covered other major standard setting and research project activity in the period. Section three, implementation activities, including the work of the interpretations committee. And then in the appendices, we've given you, if you like, a status update of all the projects on the agenda. And then the other thing I would just highlight is in appendix D, you have the work plan as it was on the 12th of October. And this is now in the format that we report the work plan on the new website, apart from the last column in this report, which is for you. And that obviously reports any changes in the timescale on these projects as they were previously reported to you. And this is going to just be a lot easier for you going forward, because I think the way we're now reporting the dates on the website is a lot clearer to track progress. So I just wanted to flag that. So what I'd like to do now, Jim, if that's okay, is sort of pick up on a few aspects in the report. So in section one, paragraph nine, I first wanted to highlight prepayment features with negative compensation. This is an amendment to IFRS 9. I think it's been flagged to this committee at each meeting this year. This amendment is designed to enable companies to measure some prepayable financial assets that have this so-called negative compensation at amortized cost rather than fair value that would otherwise have been the case without making this amendment. And what I wanted to report really was to sort of highlight that we've now completed this project. We considered all of the feedback on the exposure draft at the July board meeting, and we moved quickly to get the amendment out, and it was issued in October. And, of course, as you know, that was always important with this amendment, given its amendment to IFRS 9, and the effective date of IFRS 9 is obviously the 1st of January next year. So, in actual fact, it's, you know, we've actually sort of completed this whole project from an initial discussion with the Interpretations Committee, I think last November. We've completed it in less than a year, but still being faithful to the due process. I've also highlighted in paragraph 15 the fact that the basis for conclusions to this amendment to IFRS 9 also records the conclusion that standard setting is not required to address a question that originally came to the Interpretations Committee on modifications of financial liabilities that don't result in recognition. Now, I briefed you on this matter about developments to date at the May meeting, and we're going to talk about this in the next paper. But just to highlight that the board added these paragraphs to the basis for conclusions to this IFRS 9 amendment, basically to bring closure to the discussions that the committee and the board have had on this question about modifications of financial liabilities. And we were trying to address any uncertainty about the accounting and obviously to reduce diversity in practice. And we think that what we have added to the basis for conclusions achieves this, because in explaining the board's conclusion that standard setting isn't required to address the question, the board has confirmed the accounting that's actually required by the existing requirements in IFRS 9 for these modifications. So, moving on to the next topic, starting at paragraph 20, and this is addressing some narrow scope amendments to pension accounting. That's the pension accounting in IFRIC 14 and IAS 19, and they are very narrow scope amendments. But I'm just highlighting because I think I've previously reported that the board had considered the recommendations for the Interpretations Committee to finalize these proposed amendments in April. But since then, the board has been looking further at the effects of the IFRIC 14 amendments in the light of some further information that they received, and they have decided to undertake some further work before finalizing. Essentially, I think what the board is trying to do is exploring whether it can take the amendment up a level, if you like, and actually just establish a slightly more principle-based approach to ensure that the amendment actually has the effect that it was originally designed to do. So as a result of that, the board has effectively decided to finalize the IAS 19 amendment, which is actually unrelated other than the fact it's pension accounting also, from the IFRIC 14 amendment, and we'll finalize that separately, and we'll continue to work on the IFRIC 14 amendment. And then just very quickly, the other things to highlight in Section 1, the board confirmed that it had undertaken the appropriate due process for a clarifying amendment to IAS 28, this is a paragraph 23, on long-term interests in associates and joint ventures. And that amendment was issued in October, together at the same time with the IFRS 9 amendment I just mentioned. Further down the page of paragraph 28, the board ratified and issued an interpretation that had been developed by the Interpretations Committee, and that interpretation is designed to effectively fill a gap in our existing tax accounting for situations when there is uncertainty about the tax treatment and will that be accepted by the tax authorities. And then lastly, the board has also effectively signed off on the due process on a set of annual improvements that it will publish at the end of this year. So that's all of the due process decisions that were undertaken in the period. So if we just very quickly move on now to Section 2.
Let me pause, sorry, Henry, just to pick up any questions on that Section 1 conversation. Wiseman, please.
Yeah, it's a small thing, but I just want to check, what is the normal practice in cases where the board does not agree with the decision of the Interpretations Committee? Is it better referred back to them, or they're just overruled?
Wiseman, is your question in the context of the modifications of financial liability?
Yes.
So the process is that the committee considers the question, and then the committee decides what do they want to do. Now, in this particular case, the committee initially decided that although they agreed on what the accounting was by IFRS 9, they decided initially that they would like to develop a draft interpretation to give greater visibility to the question. Now, in accordance with the due process handbook, if the committee is going to do an interpretation, that does require the approval of the board. And in this case, the board decided that a draft and interpretation, which is proposing standard setting changes to standards, wasn't appropriate. So the matter was referred back to the Interpretations Committee, and so then they decided to go down the path of an agenda decision. And then what happened subsequently was, is that in the light of the feedback that the committee got on that tentative agenda decision, it didn't change the technical conclusion that they decided to refer the matter to the board. And so effectively, the board was asked to effectively deal with the matter, and that is why the board did what they did in effectively finalizing the IFRS 9 amendment. I think the process was...
I'm asking the question. Is it normal when a thing like this has happened and it, the interview had a recommendation that was not approved? Is it something that happens on average, or is it an exception?
Is much more the exception rather than the norm. So normally, the committee would make its decision about whether it wants to do standard setting or issue an agenda decision, and then effectively, if they go down the standard setting path, that does require approval of the board, but the board obviously takes the feedback from the committee, considers that very carefully because they're a group of experts in what is happening in the field, and therefore, I think it's unusual for the board effectively to reach a different conclusion about the need for standard setting. So it doesn't happen very often.
Can I just add to that? So I think that we try to minimize the number of circumstances where this happens, because I think in the past we had a lot more toing and froing between the Interpretations Committee and the Board than what we do now, and it's not helpful in terms of timeliness apart from anything else. And so that's why we have four Board members who are observers at the Interpretations Committee, and actually one of those is me, and now that's one of the reasons why the trustees decided to make me the Chair of the Interpretations Committee, to try and reduce the circumstances where we might have a recommendation coming from the committee that the Board might disagree with. So it's sort of supposed to help that process. But I think inevitably there will still be circumstances where we might reach different conclusions to the committee. And the example that I often give people, and I think maybe the IFRS 9 one is an example of that, is we ask the Interpretations Committee to look at a particular application question, and they, in a sense, look at it in isolation and give a response to that. And they might recommend that we need to do something specific to address that. But when it comes to the Board necessarily takes a broader perspective about what's happening to our suite of literature overall. So sometimes when the committee says they'd like to make a specific change, because the Board is sort of always at the back of its mind thinking about maintaining a set of principles-based requirements, it might disagree with that recommendation. And what we're trying to do is to minimise the circumstances where that happens, but I don't think we're ever going to remove it completely. But I think we can look at ways of improving the efficiency of that process.
Oh, please, Marco, go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I just a question on the this side. In the right moment to do that, I would say about the prepayment features with negative compensation. The report says that upgrades the risk from medium to high, and they say that there is a the users are quite unhappy with the new my question is, what is the investors' position? Do they are they in favor or not? Because it makes a difference.
Do we have any input from the voice of investor on this amendment? Did they comment in any way that we would have some sense of where investors are?
Not on this very specific question of the modifications of liabilities, which I think is what you're focusing on, Marco. And the reason why is because we were never setting a new requirement. This was just a clarification of what was already decided in the IFRS 9 requirement back when we did it in the 2009. Modify the terms of a financial instrument that's measured, even if it's measured at cost, the value of that instrument does change on the day you make that modification, which is why the Board thinks that it's appropriate to discount the new cash flow, the old interest rate, and reflect that in profit or loss. And that is consistent with the feedback we got from investors back when we were working on IFRS 9.
Thanks. Thank you, Sue.
Useful to stress that in our document, because if you remember the assessment procedure, someone told us that they are too much on the prepayer side.
Fair, very fair point. The voice of investor is very important to us, and I know there's a proactive effort to try to receive that voice and receive it in a consistent way. So, Henry, I'm going to just push us now a little bit. I'm starting to worry a little bit about time, but we'll actually, that's the type of the.
Okay, so I didn't really have anything in particular to highlight on Section 2, other than the fact that the Board has been making decisions on primary financial statements and rate regulation, and it, just to remind you, is working there towards consultation documents to be published next year. Actually, just on rate regulation, to highlight, the Board had a meeting with its consultative group on rate regulation just a couple of weeks ago, and I gather that was very positive. And then lastly, just the conceptual framework. At your last meeting, you considered the life cycle due process review. What I just wanted to report on was that the Board has been working with the on the comments that we've received on draft of the revised conceptual framework and is actually now close to moving towards actually the final ballot draft. So we expect to issue the final revised conceptual framework in the first quarter of next year. So that is proceeding as expected. And then maybe finally, just on Section 3 on implementation activities, just to highlight that the Interpretations Committee has met three times in the period, once by video, twice face-to-face. I think we had very productive meetings. We moved all of the items on our agenda to the next stage in the process. And maybe just highlight that the September discussion, in particular, we moved very quickly to address two sort of real practice questions, one of which was on IFRS 15 on the accounting for residential real estate. And we then just got the submission at the end of July, and we got a full analysis for the committee so they could actually publish a tentative agenda decision at the end of their September meeting. Be mindful here that IFRS 15, the new revenue standard, is effective at the start of next year. So really trying to, as we can, very efficient. I think, Jim, that was all I wanted to bring to the committee's attention on that paper.
Very, very good. Thank you, Henry. Any additional questions for Henry?
Please. Very small one on the very last appendix, Appendix D, oh, before last, that recognizes the expected date of a project and also the deviation from the former expected date, but it doesn't say anything about the original expected date. And I think you need to sort of keep track on where you originally were and where you are to know how much time we take, specifically also for our stakeholders.
Weissman, please.
Paragraph 39, this goodwill and impairment, is it deliberate that the consultations are just limited on the issue of simplification of impairment, not on the...
I think the scope of the work is defined to taking this impairment testing model, as well as trying to reduce the complexity in the current model for impairment testing.
I think this just reflects one of the meetings, actually, Weissman. We are looking more broadly, but I think this was a reference to this particular meeting.
I wanted to just add one more comment on the Appendix D that Elsie took us to earlier with respect to the history of the projects. And when I reviewed this and I was walking down where we had a new expected date that is later than the original forecast date, quite consistently it says, due to staff availability, due to staff availability, due to staff availability, due to staff availability. And this is super easy for me to say because I don't have to do this, but I just challenge us to, if we need to augment our staff, let's do it. Let's go hire them. Let's get additional arms and legs on the field. And again, I have nothing to do with this. This is super easy for me to say, and I know the degree of difficulty, and I just also want to balance my comment with the notion that I'm glad that we're not sacrificing quality. If we're satisfied that we haven't done what needs to be done to have quality standard setting, then we're going to put more time in the calendar. But if we are aggressive on our human resource plan and if we need more arms and legs and more horses, I say let's go get them. And then I also just encourage, and again, this is easy for me to say because I'm departing, but I would also like to see us just broaden our thinking of where can we get resources to do the research we need. And if we want to borrow resources from that very collaborative, consultative environment I felt at that World Congress of Standard Setters, let's get some national standard setters to help us on some of these projects, or let's get academics, or let's ask more of the firms. Or anyway, I just, the due to staff availability just makes me feel like we need to work harder on getting more arms and legs. But I do not want that to in any way result in us compromising the quality of the people that we're recruiting and the quality of the people that we want on the field, because the quality of our standards is more important than the quality of our calendar.